the headlines. Lawyer of an Iranian national jailed in Sweden tells Press TV court is not competent to hear Hemi Nouri's case. Russian president slams Ukraine's drone attack on Moscow as terrorism, saying Kiev is trying to intimidate Russian citizens by attacking residential buildings. And intense clashes rock Sudan's capital hours after warring factions agree to extend a shaky ceasefire for 5 more days. Hello everyone, thanks for tuning in to World News. In our top story, the lawyer of Hamid Nouri, an Iranian national jailed in Sweden for alleged rights abuses, has told Press TV about his situation. Thomas Bodström said the court lacks competence to hear the accusation leveled against his client.
First of all, this is a very strange case. I cannot understand why we should have a trial in Sweden about what happened in another country 35 years ago from a person who is not a Swedish person, what he maybe have done to other people who are not Swedes at all. So that has nothing to do with Sweden.
Bodström said that Nouri's trial has not been fair and has had so many mistakes. He said some of the witnesses introduced against the defendant had a conflict of interest in the case. Lawyer said Nouri should be acquitted despite all the evidence brought up against him. Bodström said his client lost valuable documents required for defense due to what the court claims to be erasing by mistake. Lawyer slammed the Swedish authorities for not allowing Nouri to visit his family members. He said Nouri is entitled by law to have in-person visitation. Bodström said his client has now spent more than 3.5 years in solitary confinement. He said long period was a record in Sweden.
And what I am most upset about is that he is almost isolated 24 hours a day. And now he has been there for more than 3.5 years. This will be his 4th summer in custody if they don't let him go out, which I hope they will. But so this is the worst part, because he is isolated for 7 square meters. And okay, we can come and visit him, but we cannot go more than once a week or once a week, because we are just lawyers and we are working with the case. And he has asked for new glasses so he can read better. Since we came into the case, it's almost 8-9 months. Nothing has happened. So he is treated very bad, and we complain about it all the time, but nothing happened.
Nouri was arrested upon arrival in Stockholm in November of 2019. Swedish prosecutors accuse him of involvement in the execution of members of the Mujahideen-e-Khalq terrorist organization. The group is responsible for killing at least 17,000 Iranians. Tehran has rejected the accusations against Nouri as politically motivated. The Iranian president says that unilateralism is giving way to multilateralism, where the fate of the world will be determined by regional countries and organizations. Ibrahim Raisi made the remarks in a meeting with Kairat Saribeh, visiting Secretary General of the Conference on Interaction and Confidence-Building Measures in Asia. SICA is a multinational forum for enhancing cooperation toward promoting peace, security, and stability in Asia. Raisi stressed the need for constant contact between SICA member states, saying the organization has great potential and needs to be strengthened. Saribeh hailed Iran's active participation in the organization, particularly in the fight against terrorism and boosting economic development. He called for Iran to share its experience in science and technology with other SICA members. And earlier, we spoke to SICA's Secretary General on Iran's role in the organization.
Iran is our member state from the beginning. 30 years before, the first president of Kazakhstan announced or launched the initiative to have a structure that can take care on the confidence and cooperation in Asia. And from the very beginning, Iran is a very proactive part of this process. The fact that within the last 2 years, I am coming to Iran with the visits for the third time, and that President Raisi personally took part but at the SICA 6 summit last year in Astana, Kazakhstan, shows the very serious approach of Iran to the Conference on Interaction and Confidence Building Measures in Asia. SICA is an evolving process, and we have many opportunities to extend our actions to the good deeds, and Iran plays a very significant role within this process.
Tehran has slammed the European Parliament for giving platform to ringleader of anti-Iran terror group, the MKO. In a tweet, Iran's foreign ministry spokesman said group is notorious for a dark record of terror and bloodshed. Nasser Kanani expressed regret that despite Parliament's claim of upholding human rights, some of its members have turned a blind eye to the murders of over 17,000 Iranians, including women and children. Legislature hosted leader of the Mujahideen Haq organization terror group, Maryam Rajavi, last week. MKO has carried out numerous acts of terrorism in Iran. It even sided with executed Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein and the war on Iran. EU removed the outfit from its terrorist list in 2009 following intense lobbying. U.S. followed suit in 2012. Palestinian resistance movements have hailed the recent anti-Israel operation in the northern West Bank city of Tul Karam, which led to the death of a settler. A Hamas spokesperson said the operation proved Israel's failure to defeat Palestinian resistance. He added the regime can never extinguish flames of the People's Revolution. Islamic Jihad also congratulated the resistance for this operation, calling it a natural response to Israel's crimes against Palestinians. According to Israeli media, man was shot at the entrance of the Hermesh settlement. The Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigades, a resistance group linked to the Palestinian Fatah Party, claimed responsibility. The group released a statement saying this and future operations will not be the final response to avenge their martyrs. Azerbaijan is hosting the Israeli president and his high-ranking delegation despite public backlash in the Caspian Sea country against normalization of ties with the Israeli regime. Isaac Herzog landed in Baku and received an official welcome from the Azerbaijani first deputy prime minister earlier Tuesday. Herzog also met with President Ilham Aliyev, whose country opened its embassy in Tel Aviv in March. Azerbaijan also appointed its first ever ambassador to Tel Aviv in December. But people are angry over Baku's diplomatic relations with the regime. Azerbaijanis are not the only people rejecting their government's move to normalize ties. People in some Arab states have also voiced strong opposition to a U.S. brokered normalization deal between their rulers and the Israeli regime. Russian President Vladimir Putin says Ukraine's recent drone strike on Moscow was a terrorist act.
We already mentioned the possibility of carrying strikes against decision-making centers. And of course, one of them is the headquarters of Ukrainian military intelligence, which we attacked 2 or 3 days ago. In response, the Kyiv regime chose another route. They are trying to scare Russia, scaring the people of Russia, and carrying out strikes against residential buildings. This is a clear sign of terrorist activity.
Putin said attack aimed to provoke Russia to retaliate. On Tuesday, the Russian capital was targeted by drones for the first time since war with Ukraine started last year. Strike targeted several areas, including a suburban neighborhood where the Russian president has an official residence. The Russian Defense Ministry said it was Kiev's biggest drone attack on Moscow. Russian officials said 2 people were injured as a result. A Ukrainian presidential aide denied Kiev's involvement in the strike, but said that it enjoyed watching the developments. Our correspondent Johnny Miller joined us earlier from Moscow with the latest on the recent drone attacks on the Russian capital.
Yes, well, I went to one of these sites this morning. It took me a while to find the exact site. Moscow is a big city, and the damage really is very minor. A few broken windows, not much more than that. I spoke to some of the residents who were living in that block. They were more bemused than anything else, and irritated that they had to be evacuated from their apartments at 6 o'clock. So minor damage, no casualties, but it looks like the response from Russia may be a lot more than breaking a few windows inside Ukraine. Of course, a kind of almost a mass drone attack on Russia's capital is being treated as a very serious thing here in Russia. Interesting, Vladimir Putin's words earlier today. He said that a few days ago, Russia hit the military intelligence headquarters in Kiev, it's very difficult to know how successful Russia strikes are in Kiev, because there's a media blackout. Ukrainian citizens aren't allowed to film the damage. Ukraine puts out a propaganda thing. They always shoot down all these missiles.
Divisions grow in the European Union over the bloc's relentless military support for Ukraine. EU member Hungary favors peace negotiations, and that stance is creating tensions, as our Brussels correspondent Jerome Hughes now reports.
EU leaders accuse the Hungarian government of casting democratic values aside with respect to judicial reforms and press freedom. However, analysts say their real issue is that Budapest is not towing the line with respect to the war in Ukraine. EU affairs ministers met on Tuesday to debate so-called EU values in Hungary. On her way into the meeting, Hungarian Justice Minister Judit Varga slated the European Parliament for criticising her government.
Minister Varga says that the European Parliament does not respect EU values, does not respect democracy in Hungary, does not respect rule of law. What do you think?
The European Parliament has full democratic legitimacy to adopt the resolutions in case they see the political need to do so. So that's the only comment I have.
The EU has so far spent 10 billion euro on weapons for Ukraine. EU nation Hungary is against the policy, and that seriously irks Brussels and Washington.
There is no chance to win this war. So therefore, what we should do far more energy invest into to convince everybody that the only solution is ceasefire.
Experts say Prime Minister Orban is correct to suggest the EU is concentrating too much on propelling the Ukraine war.
He definitely has a point, because here in Brussels you hear people saying, OK, it's always about Ukraine, it's Ukraine this, Ukraine that. But we should not forget the Palestinians in Gaza. We should not forget the Syrians. We should not forget the Sudanese.
It's clear the Hungarian government is a major thorn in the side of the EU project at present. However, Eurosceptic parties in other member states are on course to make significant gains in forthcoming elections, helped on by the cost of living crisis. Therefore, the problems might only be starting for the establishment here. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
And Turkey has been blocking Sweden's attempts to join the NATO alliance for months. Now, following the re-election of the Turkish president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, Europe and Washington need to consider a new strategy to get the nod from Ankara for Swedish accession into the Western Military Alliance. Robert Carter reports on the latest from the Swedish capital.
Will Sweden ever succeed in its bid to join the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, otherwise known as NATO? That is the question many are wondering after a year of back and forth on the contentious issue. The US and other NATO members have lobbied hard for a fast-tracked introduction of several Scandinavian countries in a move that deeply angered Russia. Finland's bid was successful. Sweden's, on the other hand, ran into serious problems.
Sweden and Finland both applied to join NATO last year, abandoning their traditional policies of neutrality following the start of the Ukraine conflict. Now, in order to successfully join NATO, all of its current members must support the bid. Turkey and also Hungary have yet to support Sweden's application to join the military alliance.
Turkey ratified Finland's accession in late March, but has blocked Sweden's over complaints Stockholm harbours members of groups Ankara considers terrorists. Relations between the two worsened in January when Quran burnings outside Turkey's embassy in Sweden sparked global Muslim protests. European onlookers hoped that the recent Turkish elections might open the door to NATO if Erdogan loses. Instead, he remains in power. US President Joe Biden is now forced to find an alternative strategy, possibly by enticing Ankara with promises of fighter jet sales.
I spoke to Erdogan and congratulated Erdogan, and he still wants to work on something on the F-15s. I told him we wanted to deal with Sweden so that get that done, and so we'll be back in touch with one another. But it was basically a congratulatory call.
Critics of NATO believe any move to expand the bloc is a mistake, casting doubt on NATO's true ambitions.
I was looking up some polls earlier, and throughout the last centuries, the Swedes were very opposed to NATO membership. They wanted to maintain that independence, but it's all been shifted on its head thanks to very smart propaganda. Just looking back on history, in 1999, they decided to become an offensive organization with the bombing of Yugoslavia. They have been involved in numerous other conflicts since, especially in Afghanistan and also Libya. They are not a defensive alliance.
NATO's Secretary General has expressed high hopes Sweden will indeed join the bloc. Swedish Foreign Minister said Monday he hoped to meet with his Turkish counterpart soon to discuss relations. However, Moscow has warned that the continued expansion of NATO could lead to further retaliatory measures, raising fears of further fighting in Europe. Robert Carter, Stockholm.
Intense clashes have resumed in Sudanese capital Khartoum, despite an agreement between warring factions to extend a ceasefire, which was mediated by Saudi Arabia and the U.S. New clashes came after Sudan's army and paramilitary rapid support forces agreed to extend a truce for 5 more days. Ceasefire was first announced on May 20th and expired on Monday. Residents reported fighting in all 3 adjoining cities, which make up the greater Khartoum. Both sides accuse each other of violating the truce. Mediators say the ceasefire has allowed the delivery of humanitarian aid despite repeated violations. Thanks for tuning in and goodbye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید. ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, if you remember, we said that the Islamic Revolution and its unmatched leader, Imam Khomeini, drew the attention of the world thinkers from the very beginning. For a couple of episodes, we have dwelt upon the views of French thinker Michel Foucault on Imam Khomeini. Today, we are going to make you familiar with the views of another thinker who has also paid attention to the nature of the Islamic Revolution and the character of Imam Khomeini. He is Hamed Algar, teacher of Islamic studies in Berkeley University of California. Stay tuned, please. Hamed Algar was born in Britain in 1940. He has taught for years as the professor of Islamic studies and Farsi language in Berkeley University. He is also a specialist of Shia history in Iran and the Naqshbandiye mysticism in the Central Asia, India, Turkey, and the Balkans. Algar has got his BA and PhD from the University of Cambridge and also an honorary doctorate from Tehran University. This thinker embraced Islam and then Shia school of thought. Algar has translated into English some works of the contemporary Muslim thinkers like Ayatollah Murtaza Mutahhari, Ayatollah Taleghani, and Dr. Shariati. He has also translated some works of the great leader of the Islamic Ummah, Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him. He said in an interview in 2003 that he had first concentrated his studies on the contemporary history of Iran, but then extended his studies on other regions. Algar has traveled to various Islamic countries such as Iran, Turkey, and Afghanistan, and his writings have been translated and published in different languages. He had a private meeting with Imam Khomeini shortly after the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979. Hamid Algar believes that in January 1979, when the Shah escaped from the country, it became definite that the Islamic Revolution would triumph. Algar maintains that the appointment of Shapur Bakhtiar as the prime minister by the Shah in the waning days of the latter's stay in Iran was doomed to failure and had no chance of success. Contrary to what the American statesmen thought in the final days of the life of the despotic regime of Pahlavi, there was no possibility of military coup in Iran. 2 weeks after the escape of the Shah, Imam Khomeini returned home after nearly 15 years of living in exile. Then, within just 10 days, the royal system was toppled and the Islamic Revolution triumphed. British thinker Hamid Algar considers this revolution a great event from two aspects. Firstly, the people's participation was unprecedented in the movements of the 20th century and even the centuries before. Secondly, the revolution was unique in terms of ideology, organization, and above all, leadership. He writes, "Generally, every big and small city in Iran was mobilized against the Pahlavi regime, and men and women from every social class showed their inclination to overthrow the royal regime and end being the stooge of foreigners. The first examples of uprisings and protests against the regime or foreign meddling, such as the Constitutional Revolution in the first decade of the 20th century, or the struggle after the Second World War to nationalize the oil industry, had failed to mobilize the people in such a broad and deep manner." Hamid Algar is of the opinion that the irreligious forces like nationalists and left groups had no prominent personality to be able to mobilize and organize the masses of people who are ready to sacrifice their life for achievement of an ideological goal. He continues, "There was no other person in Iran to be comparable to Imam Khomeini and his call." British researcher Hamid Algar says the role of Imam Khomeini was not just a symbolic role of ethics, inspiration, and leadership. He was considered the practical leader of the revolution. Although some of the Iranian activists would give him views on detailed issues, he would make key and important decisions himself, and from the very beginning, he shut the mouths of all advocates of compromising with the Shah through insisting on the dissolution of kingdom and establishment of the Islamic government. Without this insistence and the competence of Imam Khomeini to keep the loyalty and obedience of the Iranian masses, this victorious revolution wouldn't go beyond another transient and fruitless conflict in the history of Iran. it was the Imam who applied concepts like martyrdom and justice to mobilize the people and directed the nationwide descent toward a great change. Algar continues, the 1979 revolution was completely Islamic in nature, and the participation of irreligious elements in it was absolutely marginal. For instance, neither the National Front nor the Tudeh Party played any important role in the revolution. Most of the persons who fought the regime in the final days of its rule, contrary to what has been claimed, were not the leftists, but the men of mosques and committees of revolution who were loyal to Imam Khomeini. They formed the main core of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps after the victory. Hamid Algar also says that many of the ulema sacrificed their lives for the triumph of the Islamic Revolution. Dear listeners, next time we will continue with his views.
Food for thought.
Salam, and here is some fresh food for thought to start the day. Imam Reza, peace upon him, narrates that his illustrious ancestor, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, when asked by a person on the rights of the father upon son, said, he should not call his father by name. He should not walk ahead of him. He should not sit until his father has seated himself. And he should not do such acts as a result of which people abuse his father.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, self-grooming. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of self-grooming in the Islamic lifestyle. We know that Islam gives importance to the purification, and one of the reasons that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has created us and He has given us the material aspect of the life and the spiritual aspect is that we need to purify ourselves in order to reach the perfection. And this purification is in everywhere, even in the food, in eating, in talking, in clothing. So purification is very important. And that's why we see the very first thing that we can say it is the one of the most important things to have the self-grooming or self-adornment is to have wudu and ghusl. This wudu that we do every day before the daily prayer, it is said, it is recommended to be in the state of wudu. Being in the state of wudu means that when I'm the whole day in the state of wudu, I'm not performing impurified things. And I am going towards the purification. I want to keep myself neat and clean. On the other hand, there is ghusl as well. For example, the ghusl or the bath for the day of Jum'ah or the other days. For example, Eid day, there are special, we can say, instructions about this bath. So being neat and clean and being in the state of wudu is very important. And also we know that even it is said that if a person sleeps in the night and before sleeping he performs the wudu, he has spent his whole night in praying Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of self-grooming in the Islamic lifestyle. We said that the very first thing in Islamic lifestyle we see in order to have self-adornment or self-grooming is to be in the state of wudu and to perform ghusl. And there are many things like which is said about the ghusl. There are different types of it, so we need to know about that. The second thing that we can talk about is to have the neat and clean clothing. We need to have neat and clean clothes, and recommended is that we need to have the white or the green color, for example, or the use the light color clothing, and they should be neat. It is not necessary to have new clothes every time, obviously. We need to put on neat and clean clothes, and you can see the difference that the people who have neat and clean clothing compared to those who do not have this, there is a big difference. And even if a person who says, for example, I only have one piece of cloth or two pieces of clothes to wear on, then it is important for him to take care of the clothes and to keep them neat and clean and to change them on time so that they don't get so dirty. So it is important in the Islamic lifestyle that when we talk about the self-adornment, we should look good, look neat and clean, inshallah. The third thing is to use a good perfume. And the last is to use the mirror. Now, we know that we use the mirror and we adorn ourselves. So this is also recommended by Islam to keep looking at the mirror, adorn yourself, make right your hairs, and look at yourself, how you look. And on top of that, use the good perfume so that people do not run away because of the bad smell sometimes we have. Rather, they don't feel bad about you when they're sitting next to you, when they're talking to you. And that's why brushing teeth are also recommended so much in Islam. Why? Because when we talk, our mouth should not smell bad. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Football versus enemies. Part 1.
Throughout history, football has been associated with many memories and meanings for Iranian people. Bitter and sweet meanings whose images have been recorded in our collective memory like important historical events. Not many phenomena can be affected from the surrounding conditions like football and leave an impact on them. Not many phenomena around us have been able to show us to ourselves, just like the most popular sport among Iranians has. Sometimes, entire Iranian nation is involved in this sport by playing it, by celebrating it, by crying, or by suffering. Football is a sport that records our historical memories in a plain language that can be understood by everyone. Football gives the power structure the capability to take control of society's excitement and passion. That's why power structures use people's determination to achieve victory to their own advantage. On the one hand, they encourage them to achieve victory, and on the other, they rein in the emotion stemming from it. But people's desire to achieve victory and success grows by the day. We all want to grow, winning, achieving victory, and embracing victory. But there's another side to such victories, failure and loss. In football, failures are heartbreaking, destructive, and catastrophic. They can affect not only the players, teams, and fans, but also nations. We ignore the official history of football. Football can be one of the signs of attachment and collective identity in any land. The contemporary texts do not mention it because they think that football is just a sport. Iranians' first encounter with football dates back to the Qajar era. Muzaffar-ed-Din Shah Qajar, who had traveled to Europe, got bored of watching the game. He said that all players could be given a ball so they wouldn't have to run after one ball and wouldn't get so confused. During those days, Muzaffar-ed-Din Shah Qajar signed a 60-year oil contract with the UK to give them the right to extract and sell oil. All rights were given to Darcy. At the same time, football had turned into a new entertainment in Britain with its established rules and a large part of the population interested in it. So when Britons were constructing the establishment to extract oil in Iran, they set the stage for football and brought their new entertainment to Iran. The southern Iranian cities didn't even have the basic facilities for living, let alone facilities to spend your spare time. The living and accommodation standards for the British workers was much better than the Iranian workers. During the worst days of the Iranian workers, the Britons got their own architects to construct the first football stadium in Iran in order to provide their workers with an entertainment with the revenues earned from Iranian oil. The first football match was held between the local workers in Masjid Soleiman and the British workers. The result of the game was already clear for the British side. After Reza Khan came to power as a prime minister, an association named the Association for Promotion and Spreading Football was established in 1921 in Tehran. Following an increase in oil sales to Britain, the government's revenues were also increased so it could pave the ground to display the fake satisfaction of society so that society would feel a little relieved. Reza Khan made a lot of changes in the Iranian people's lifestyles against their wishes and beliefs. He felt the need to introduce entertainment that could distract the people. In 1938, Iran's national team was officially formed and played against Afghanistan on the day that Amjadieh Stadium was established. After the Second World War broke out, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, who was the captain of the Leroux School's football team in Switzerland, ascended the throne. Football got special attention because of his personal interests in it. It also led the new government to focus on football. In 1945, the Taj Club was established with the support of the monarchy and was initially named the Bicyclists. Military and political figures were designated as the managers of the club. In that era, according to the FIFA ranking, the Taj Club was the second wealthiest team after Real Madrid. In those years, Real Madrid had become Europe's champions for 5 consecutive years. Real Madrid, too, was a royal team in Spain, and Madrid was the capital of the monarchy. So, Real Madrid and Taj were similar in many ways. The hike in political tensions those years led to the U.S. orchestrated coup on August 15, 1953, which caused a serious rift among people and their beliefs. The army wasn't detached from the conflict. The army personnel loyal to the Shah were promoted and the opponents faced fury. The Shaheen team was formed as Taj's rival in the same city. Shaheen was the only team that could face Taj. It turned into a venue where people could show their indignation. People chanted slogans against the Shah at the Amjadia Stadium on the day he went to the stadium to watch the championship games. It made the Shah furious and he left the stadium with a bad memory. It was a precursor to dissolve the Shaheen Club. We can see traces of Parviz Khosravani, then managing director of the club, in the dissolution of the club. General Khosravani was one of Marshal Zahedi's fellow comrades in recapturing the ruling in favor of the Shah during the 1953 coup. After that coup, he wielded a lot of power. A year after Shaheen was dissolved, he was appointed as president of the sports organization. After Shaheen was dissolved, the club's fans didn't follow the matches. When Shaheen collapsed, after consultations with Ali Abdu, the owner of the newly established Persepolis club, Shaheen players joined the team. Persepolis was established in 1963. Because of the events, Persepolis represented the people and Taj represented the monarchy. It was the beginning of exciting derbies in Iran that continue to this very day. Football reached its climax in Iran, but it wasn't outstanding on the international level. Iran was full of football talent, but it had never achieved any success up to that time. 1967, Tehran. The Nations Cup in Tehran was the first serious international test for Iran's football. The bout between Iran and Israel in the final match was the most important social and political event in the games, because for both people and some politicians, ties between Iran and Israel were tense. As a Muslim nation, Iranians would not accept aggression by Israel and the Zionist rulers against Palestinians. As the people didn't get a chance to fight against Israel, they viewed the green field in Amjadieh as a battlefield.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The United States spent $1.1 trillion of federal discretionary money on militarism in past year. This left less than two-fifths of the discretionary budget for public health, education, environment, and more. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Noted, a staggering majority of the U.S. federal discretionary budget went toward so-called defense and other militaristic and carceral programs in the past year. A new report reveals as U.S. defense spending continues to reach new heights. According to an analysis by the Institute for Policy Studies, IPS, released recently, the U.S. spent $1.1 trillion of the discretionary budget on militarism and war last year, including funding for the Pentagon and law enforcement agencies like the Department of Homeland Security. This amounts to 62% of the $1.8 trillion allotted to discretionary spending in total in fiscal year 2023, a pool of spending that is also meant to fund programs for public health, education, housing, disaster relief, the environment, scientific research, and more. As a result of the huge amount of spending allocated to military and law enforcement, less than $2 of every $5 of the budget was spent on such public programs in fiscal year 2023. Even though the vast majority of the total $1.1 trillion was spent on weapons and the Pentagon, the budget for federal law enforcement alone, $31 billion, was double the budget for child care and early childhood education last year. Tellingly, IPS found that the U.S. spent 16 times more on weapons and the Pentagon at $920 billion than it did on foreign humanitarian aid and diplomacy. This represents a huge increase in spending on militarism from previous years. According to the analysis, adjusted for inflation, such spending has increased by 94% since 2001. Report author Lindsay Kashagarian, IPS's National Priorities Project Program Director, said, "When we invest so heavily in militarism at home and abroad, we deprive our own communities and people of solutions to problems that pose immediate security threats. We underfund programs to end poverty, provide affordable housing, bolster public education, and protect clean air and water at our peril," Kashagarian continued. Spending on militarism takes up the majority of the federal discretionary budget, and it has grown faster than all other spending. If we keep up these patterns, we are hurtling toward a future where we can't afford the basics of a civilized society. These massive increases in spending for initiatives like the increased militarization of the southern border and the failed war on drugs have only led to the U.S. having the highest rate of incarceration in the world, while the U.S. military, conquests like its wars in the West Asia region, have sapped trillions away from U.S. taxpayers and yielded millions of deaths in the region. Meanwhile, hundreds of billions of this spending goes to private defense contractors, with roughly half of the Pentagon budget going to defense contractors each year. This amounts to tens of billions of dollars of pure profits for corporations like Lockheed Martin and Raytheon, who, a former Pentagon official revealed in an interview aired recently, have been intentionally gouging the prices of weapons and equipment in order to make as much profit from federal contracts as possible. But still, Congress continues to fund these militarized programs, the military, homeland security, and federal law enforcement, nearly as a matter of faith, the report says. Indeed, Congress increases the amount that the government spends on the Pentagon, the only federal agency that has never passed an audit, nearly every year. This spending is on track to reach a new high for fiscal year 2024, with the White House issuing a record high request for $886 billion in discretionary funding for defense next year, including $842 billion for the Pentagon. For some lawmakers, the U.S.'s absurdly bloated defense budget still isn't enough. In talks over their far-right debt ceiling wish list, Republicans have been saying that they want to push military spending even higher, while also demanding cuts in overall spending for healthcare and public programs. Meanwhile, National Priorities Project reported, as the United States barrels headlong toward a possible historic debt default, a report published recently highlights that the majority of this year's federal discretionary funds were used for militarized programs, while urging the U.S. government to reprioritize spending to serve human needs instead of the mechanisms and machinery of violence. The report entitled The War for State: How Funding for Militarism Compromises Our Welfare was published by the Institute for Policy Studies National Priorities Project, NPP, which aims to inspire people and movements to take action to federal resources, prioritize peace, shared prosperity, and economic security for all. Our country's economy faces a dire threat from so-called fiscal conservatives, including the present GOP House majority, who have resorted to dangerous brinksmanship to force deep cuts in the federal discretionary budget, the report states. The report added the discretionary budget contains the Pentagon budget as well as a number of other broadly militarized line items, including nuclear weapons, federal immigration enforcement, law enforcement, prisons, and so on. The paper continues, that same budget also hosts most social programs outside of Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and the Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program. It includes federal jobs programs, education, scientific research, and the like. And this is referring to what critics and even one congressional Republican have called hostage taking over the debt ceiling. Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and this is Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. In today's programme, we'll be examining the activities of an obscure British charity known as Yakab UK that was founded in 2011. Yakab claims on its website that its primary mission is to empower British Jews to support a political resolution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. The website also states that Yakab wants to end Israel's occupation. Aside from the fact that it's an illegal occupation, not a conflict, how truthful is their statement about wanting to bring the occupation to an end? We'll be discussing this after Latifa Abu Chakra's report into Yakab's links to hardline Zionist organisations and individuals.
Yakab UK is a Zionist group linked to the Israeli embassy that claims its purpose is to work with organisations that fight the occupation. Yakab is a proud member of the Board of Deputies, which boasts in its 2020 trustees report of a close working relationship with the Israeli embassy, the Ministry of Strategic Affairs, and the IDF spokesman department. In July 2020, Yakab received a briefing by Ami Ayalon, the former head of Israel's internal intelligence agency, Shin Bet. Yakab, in its own trustees report, claims to work closely with political partners in Israel and enthusiastically states that two of its former fellows are now on the National Council of the Zionist Federation. The board of the so-called anti-occupation Yakab once featured the notorious former employee of the Israeli embassy, Ella Rose. Pictured here on a lobbying trip with Israeli government figures, Ella Rose worked as a public affairs officer at the Zionist embassy between 2015 and 2016 before being directly dispatched to the Jewish Labour Movement, which is affiliated with the World Zionist Organization. Another link to that sordid section of the lobby is Mike Katz, who sits on the board of Yakab at the same time as being the national chair of the JLM. Another member of the Yakab board, Rob Geist-Pinfold, is simultaneously a research fellow at the Israeli intelligence think tank, the Institute for National Security Studies. The director of the think tank is Amos Yadlin. The former head of Israeli military intelligence, Yakab also coordinated with one of Israel's three national institutions, the United Jewish Israel Appeal. The UJIA has hosted a school tour for the supposedly anti-occupation organization Yakab. Interestingly, while Yakab claims to oppose settlements, its helpful partner, UJIA, has been found to take British citizens for overnight stays in illegal Israeli settlements on tours of occupied Palestine. The links between Yakab and the UJIA do not end there. The chair of Yakab, Simon Sadi, was previously the founding chair of the UJIA business division. That doesn't sound very anti-occupation to me. Another interesting connection between Yakab and the illegal settlements that it claims to oppose is in its funding. The Peirce Foundation finances Yakab, which is not surprising, as Hannah Weisfeld, a former consultant to the Peirce Foundation, is now the director of Yakab. How cozy! What is less known is the Peirce Foundation funds the Hebrew University in occupied Al-Quds, which takes students from Oxford University to stay in the illegal French Hill settlement. The Peirce Foundation is also invested in a plethora of other Zionist pro-occupation organizations. The only difference is that Yakab masquerades as anti-occupation.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and a former professor at Bristol University. And he's now a non-resident senior research fellow at the Centre for Islam and Global Affairs at Istanbul Zeyum University. He's also a co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch, and he's a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. Our expert guest today is Mick Napier. Mick is a lifelong anti-racist socialist and a veteran campaigner for Palestinian liberation. He's the secretary of the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign, and he's led many successful campaigns against the Zionist lobby. His effective advocacy for the Palestinian cause saw Zionists resort to lawfare tactics in order to close him down. But their